This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Concert on Thursday, January 25th at 7:30 p.m. It's at the Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church located at 2025 West 11th Street at TC Jester. So we'll be talking to them. And in the second hour,
we have Queer Music Heritage because it's the fourth Monday of the month. And I'm talking with Trett Fury, one of the women's music icons, and she's got a lot to say. It's a very interesting interview.
Well, and before we get into all of that, of course, we'll have This Way Out with News Wrap and not audiophile this week because it's
That's next week, yes.
So all of that's featuring there, but you said you saw Dream Girls.
I saw Dream Girls, and yes, I did like it a lot, and Jennifer Hudson is just magic. It's like I knew when that moment in the film was like, here it comes. And the audience applauded. How many times do you see that in a movie?
Yes, well, when I saw it on stage here in Houston, at the end of the first act, they gave Jennifer Holliday?
Hudson.
Well, no, in the stage play.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Holliday gave her a standing ovation, mm-hmm. which was just incredible. So, keeping up with music.
Yeah, I had one misgiving about the movie, though.
Yeah.
It tried too hard to be the Supreme story, and it's not the Supreme story. Every album cover that they showed during the scenes mm-hmm. were exact ripoffs of the artwork the Supremes covers.
Interesting.
And it's not the Supreme story. Flo Bauert isn't in it. Flo Bauert died poor. It's not her story.
Well, it was sort of, I guess, loosely based on the concept.
But they try too hard. Tell your own story. Don't try and tell both.
Well, as you know, we've been keeping up with the story about whether Pride Parade in 2008 is going to move downtown and change the dates.
Do we know yet?
Well, what has happened is that the board has put out a press release saying that they will revisit it during this year's celebration and make a final decision in the August board meeting. And the board meeting isn't scheduled yet, but they will let people know when that meeting is going to be in July, when the August meeting is.
Okay, so 2007 as planned. Watch it closely.
Right. And if you didn't see the Chronicle yesterday, there's an editorial which you can look up online. And the idea, it's titled, "The Idea to Relocate the Pride Parade and Festival from Montrose to Downtown Should Be Reconsidered." And it's really interesting. It talks about the historical significance of the Stonewall Riots. That is in the June, and that we're the only major city in the region to do it then. It's not that much cooler in September. And it also talks about this. You know, it's one of the best known gay celebrations happens in Houston because it happens into the unique neighborhood of Montrose.
And what's special, this is the city paper having this discussion.
Yes. One of the largest papers in the country has done an editorial. And, I mean, it's up to the board of directors to make that decision. But I thought it was real interesting that the Chronicle, you know, covered it and sort of made their recommendations. It talked about the fact that when the International Festival moved out to the Reliant area.
Oh, that was a walking disaster.
Yes. Of course, the weather was also bad then, too. But it was a disaster, yes, because the International Festival works very well downtown because it has all the skyscrapers mm-hmm. and people got used to it. And you have all these different
spaces. And it's in a park, and it's nice.
Yes. So we'll just see what happens. This year, of course, the Pride Festival and Parade will be in Montrose. And I guess we'll just have to wait to see what the decision is going to be for next year. Let's go to News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Don Lupo.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 20th, 2007. A gay man in the Czech Republic won a landmark ruling this week against a prospective employer for denying him a job based solely on his sexual orientation. 43-year-old Lex Sidor was promised a job as a masseur at a health rehabilitation center, but the manager refused to hire him after he found out that Sidor is gay. It's the first time that a Czech court has ruled on an issue of workplace sexual orientation discrimination. Sidor was awarded 70,000 crowns in damages, around $3,200, and the rehabilitation center was ordered to issue a formal apology. Sidor told reporters that he took his case to court because the company that refused to hire him didn't even try to hide the reason. When I spoke to the director, he said, "He looked me straight in the eye and told me that he cannot afford to employ me because I am gay." In court, the Biscayne Rehabilitation Center claimed someone who was better qualified had applied for the job. But after the ruling, its spokesperson, Tomas Zelasco, admitted that the center feared that its clients would react negatively to a gay masseur. The Czech queer rights group Gay Initiative said it hopes the ruling will inspire others to courageously fight similar acts of discrimination.
Sider's successful workplace discrimination lawsuit follows last year's passage of legislation to allow gay and lesbian couples in the Czech Republic to register their partnerships. And after 17 years in the LGBT rights movement, Jiří Hromada announced late last week that Gay Initiative, the rights group he's led for the past 7 years, is closing down. Of course, all the work is not done, Hromada told Radio Prague, but the goals we set out in 1990 have been accomplished. Especially in the legislative realm, the status of gays and lesbians has massively improved. In the first poll done on homosexuality in 1990, only 10% said they could imagine a gay person as their neighbor. Last year, they did a similar poll connected with registered partnerships and found that 70% of Czechs accept our differences. That is the main goal we sought to accomplish. The biggest task now facing the queer community, says Hromada, isn't convincing non-gay people to be more tolerant, but convincing more LGBT people to come out. We did a survey last year with help from the EU within our own gay minority, he said. What we found was that many people unnecessarily fear the negative consequences of coming out, consequences that seldom actually happen. Other LGBT advocacy groups will continue the push for full equality in the Czech Republic, focusing on gaining all the rights of marriage for same-gender couples and a higher profile in the mass media, Hromada said, adding that, I want people to not be afraid to fight for their rights.
Taiwan's LGBT community is becoming more vocal in its demands for civil rights. Activists demonstrated on January 12th in front of Parliament to demand passage of a bill that would protect gays and lesbians from employment discrimination. It's passed in committee, but opposition from conservative religious groups, led by the Alliance for Life, has blocked it from moving forward. They claim the measure will not only protect gays and lesbians, but pedophiles and those who engage in bestiality. But lesbian-gay activist Wu Shu-Liang told reporters that we don't want special privileges, we just need our rights as citizens and as people. To kill this bill is to deny our right to a livelihood. Queer rights leaders are also pressing the government to move forward with a proposal to recognize same-gender relationships, another piece of legislation opposed by church groups. The cabinet approved a measure in 2003 to create civil unions, but all attempts to advance the bill in parliament have thus far failed. Activists insist, however, that the fact that the bills were even drafted signals the growing strength of the island's lesbi-gay community. The first official pride parade was held in Taiwan last October. Several thousand members of the LGBT community and their supporters marched through the center of Taipei, the capital city.
Carrying banners and waving rainbow flags, about 150 people gathered in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican on January 13th to protest the anti-queer pronouncements of Pope Benedict XVI. The demonstration, sponsored by the national LGBT advocacy group Archegay, also commemorated the 9th anniversary of the self-immolation suicide of writer Alfredo Armando. He doused himself with gasoline and set himself on fire in St. Peter's Square on January 13, 1998, to protest the Roman Catholic Church's condemnation of LGBT people. He died of his burns 9 days later. In his suicide note, Armando wrote at length about feeling rejected by the church and the pain it had caused him. Some of the demonstrators laid floral tributes to Armando. They also carried banners calling on the Italian government to legalize same-gender unions. One banner read, "Less Vatican, more self-determination." The center-left coalition of Prime Minister Romano Prodi is reportedly still drafting a bill to grant limited partnership rights to Italian gay and lesbian couples. Prodi himself, however, has said he's opposed to full marriage equality. Benedict has constantly railed against same-gender unions since he became pope in April 2005. He even condemned queer couples in his recent Christmas message. In his latest salvo last week, he told a gathering of local Italian government officials that granting legal recognition to lesbian and gay couples was dangerous and counterproductive, as they inevitably weaken and destabilize the legitimate family based on matrimony. Benedict has promised to use all the powers of the Vatican to defeat any bill granting rights to same-gender couples.
A widely circulated press release from the British queer advocacy group Outrage this week called on activists around the world to protest draconian laws proposed in Nigeria that would subject gays and lesbians or anyone who even associates with them to as much as 5 years in prison. But Scott Long, who heads the Office of LGBT Concerns at Human Rights Watch, an organization devoted to protecting abused people around the world, issued an urgent email warning that any protests lodged with the Nigerian government would hurt, not help, the cause of LGBT people there. "Please, people, do not flood Nigerian consulates and embassies with protest letters at this time," he wrote. "It is emphatically not what the Nigerian activists who are in the forefront of the struggle want right now." Long charged outrage with failing to consult with activists in Nigeria as to the best course of action, writing that, "I'm sure this initiative was entirely well-intentioned, but Nigerian activists are angry." He says he's heard from the country's leading queer and human rights groups who've told him that trying to pressure the Nigerian government would be counterproductive. There is no evidence right now that the bill is moving forward. It has been stalled in committee in the legislature for months, Long wrote. He said Nigerian activists are hoping the measure will die a quiet death as the current legislative session comes to a close. Long wrote that lawmakers are not likely to take up the bill unless something, such as an international campaign, pushes them to. As we record this report, there's been no response from outrage.
Iraq's government this week strongly criticized a UN human rights report about its civilian death toll in 2006, saying it discussed subjects that are taboo in Iraq, such as homosexuality. The current environment of impunity and lawlessness invites a heightened level of insecurity for homosexuals in Iraq, the report says. Armed Islamic groups and militias have been known to be particularly hostile toward homosexuals, frequently and openly engaging in violent campaigns against them. There have been a number of assassinations of homosexuals in Iraq. But government spokesperson Ali al-Dabah told reporters that there was information in the report that we cannot accept here in Iraq. The report, for example, spoke about the phenomenon of homosexuality and giving them their rights. Such statements are not suitable to the Iraqi society. This is rejected. They should respect the values and traditions here in Iraq, he said. Iraqi exiles who are in touch with gay and lesbian friends in the country continue to report abductions and murders of people believed to be homosexual by organized death squads. Those often militia-based groups, claiming to be enforcing Sharia or fundamentalist Islamic law, have also been summarily executing people for listening to Western pop music, wearing shorts or jeans, drinking alcohol, working in a barber shop, dancing, or even having a Sunni name. Women have been killed for not being veiled or walking in the street unaccompanied by a male relative. Iraqi lesbi-gay activists living in exile say that the increase in U.S. troops recently proposed by President Bush will do little to end the pogroms against LGBT people or the general sectarian violence that began in the country soon after the U.S. invasion in 2003.
But finally, Britain's Secretary of State for Education and Skills, Alan Johnson, told BBC Radio 4 this week that he'd like to see the queer rights anthem, "Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay," included in a book for school children. The government's 21st Century Songbook is a £10 million project designed to encourage singing in schools. Johnson has outspokenly supported the pending sexual orientation regulations, which ban discrimination in the UK based on sexual orientation in the provision of goods and services. He stressed, however, that the song is only his personal choice. But Anne Widdecombe, a columnist for the Daily Express, wrote that this type of moral discussion should be left for when children are much older. Songs will be nominated by students and teachers. Composer Howard Goodall will make the final selections. "Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay" was written by musician and activist Tom Robinson for the 1976 London Pride March. His Tom Robinson Band recording of the song in 1978 reached number 18 on the British charts.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 20th, 2007, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watt.
And I'm Don Lupo.
Who I need to be. Well, she'd send me off to school in a frilly dress with my ponytail curled just so. I'd grab my baseball glove on my way out the door. She'd just shake her head and say, "Don't you know that I'm your mother? Let me tell you who you need to be. Listen to your mother. I'm gonna tell you who you need to be. for the world out there.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
When I came back home, she said,
where'd you get those clothes?
And what did you do to your hair? Mom, I'm not perfect, but I'm who I need to be.
Who I need to be.
No, I'm not perfect, but I'm who I need to be.
Need to be.
What hit the fan? She said, how could you do this to me? Don't you know you're supposed to be? Supposed to be with a man. Mom, I'm not perfect, but I'm who I need to be.
Who I need to be.
No, I'm not perfect, but I'm.
A fairly new artist from California. She goes by the name Link, L-I-N-Q. Her CD is called Fast Moving Dream.
This is Queer Voices.
It's music night, as Jack already said earlier, and in addition to QMH, later in the show, we have representatives from the Houston Pride Band and also the Q of Olympus. And why? Well, you find out why the Q person is here.
Crew.
Sorry.
It looks strange because it's
this.
A K.
Yeah. I'm new at this.
Okay.
We have Troy Villamont and Bill O'Rourke. Troy, what's your connection with all this?
Oh, my connection is multifold. I am currently a member of the Houston Pride Band, and we want to talk about our upcoming concert and our special guest this week.
And you have a new director.
Yes, we do. The Houston Pride Band is very proud to welcome our new artistic director. He's been our interim director on a while. Very talented young man by the name of Jason Stevens. And this will be his first full production concert, totally under his artistic direction. And he's done a great job.
Well, tell us a little bit about Jason.
Jason? Well, he's we just want to call him Button because he's so cute.
Jack, what you know, is he single?
No, I'm just asking.
Jason, I believe, is a graduate of the University of Lamar in Beaumont, or Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas. And he came to us about a year and a half. He plays the bassoon, the Q of Olympus. he plays the bassoon. He is an excellent bassoonist, or is that bassinist?
Don't look at me.
Anyway, he blows his horn, and he does it quite well. I believe he plays many other instruments as well.
So he's in the band, and the leader of the band.
That's right. He is our artistic director, and he helps to compile, compose, rewrite, direct, orchestrate. It's kind of chief cook and bottle washer. It's great.
How many are in the band?
Currently, I think we're about 30 people in the band. Mm-hmm. We're a group that varies in size from season to season.
Is that enough to be a big Pride band, or?
Oh, absolutely. There's always room for more at the Houston Pride Band, and we would love to see hundreds and hundreds of musicians join us. And y'all are all welcome to, of course. But currently, we have performed concerts with as few as 8 people and as many as 35 on stage in recent years.
How old's the band?
The band is about to celebrate our 30th birthday. We are
30th?
Yes, we were formerly the Montrose Symphonic Orchestra, and we are in year 29, so you know for year 30, this is our 206-207 concert season that we will be wrapping up with our next concert in the spring. And then we're going to go into our 07-08 concert season, and that will hold our celebration for the 30th year of the Houston Pride Band, formerly known as the Montrose Symphonic
Orchestra.
How
many years
has
the person that's been with you the longest been there?
Oh.
Hard to phrase that question. I think you understood, though.
There's a golden opportunity there.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Step right in and say, oh, I don't know, he's about 80.
Yeah. She's older than dirt. we've had, I think we have members that have been here over 20 years, and I'd say there's several of them currently playing that have been involved in the band for at least 20 years.
Well, that speaks well of the group.
Oh, it's a great organization to belong to.
So, when was your last concert?
Our last concert was in the fall, and okay. It was called Spooked on Classics.
It didn't seem that long ago, but time flies when you're doing this stuff.
Time flies, let me tell you, and it takes a lot to prepare for one of these. So to put on 4 self-produced concerts a season is quite an undertaking. We have production committees, we have people in charge of instruments, gathering music. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work from our partners and our friends that we affectionately refer to as Band-Aids.
Do you have to get rights to perform music?
Yes, I believe so. That's not, you know, I'm just a percussionist. You know, I don't take care of that part of it. I'm
if
sure.
If you don't know the answers, just make them up.
When you give your summer concert, I want that answer.
Okay. Yeah, let me jot that down for you. Okay?
And that's just the self-produced concerts. Like he was saying, they also have several smaller groups. And one reason that the crew is guest lining at this concert is because on our 12th night party on January 6th, just passed, we had one of their smaller groups, the Jazz Ensemble, come and perform for us. And once they got going, they got going. That was good jazz.
Yes, we're very proud of our new Jazz Ensemble, and they're affectionately referred to as Random Outburst. They're all Houston. Why are you laughing? They're all Houston Pride Band members, and they have represented us at many functions in the community recently and have represented us really well. Go, girls. I love you.
So you decided, no Christmas show. We're going to do one the end of January when people have more time.
Correct. For the past 2 years, we've done a holiday performance. Mm-hmm. And they were quite successful. And this year, we thought we'd kind of get into the season of Mardi Gras and celebrate that part of it with everything that's gone on in New Orleans and the rich history that Houston has. And Mardi Gras is becoming so big here in the Houston-Galveston area. We wanted to take advantage of that and get involved in the community that way. So we are very excited to have our special guests appearing with us. The crew of Olympus will be joining us on stage in various different forms Thursday night. I think you're going to see...
They have a lot of forms.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, do they have forms?
Well, you know, there's a lot of split in some of the traditions.
Let's hear your side of this, Bill.
Okay. So some of the traditions with Mardi Gras, you know, split between sort of like the formal balls and parades and the street life with the, you know, throw me some beads, mister, and do you want to wrap this?
Wrap what? What's that?
Never mind.
This.
Okay.
What's that?
So anyway, we do have both represented on that night. We've got a what we call our Silver Circle, which is some of our past royalty. Also, our current royalty will be showing off some of their costumes, minus the back pieces. I mean, they're usually huge, but we had to get them through smaller doors. And then, earlier in the concert, we'll have a group of our dancers who do normally the street parade type things, and we had to promise that they would wear sarongs so we could get them in the dark.
Yes, costume approval was necessary.
Rehearsals must be hell.
Oh, let me tell you.
Tone it down, girl.
I know. Put 6 queens on the stage with live music and feathers, and look what you get.
So, what musical influences are going into here? Kind of sum it up with.
You're going to hear a lot of traditional Mardi Gras, jazz, more the spirit of carnival or carnival, whichever way you want to take it. the traditional from all points of the world. We're not the only culture that celebrates this time of year, so we wanted to really incorporate some of the South American influence, the Latin influence, and of course just a hint of the New Orleans influence.
And some Cajun, I believe?
Just a little bit, maybe.
Tell me about that.
May some little Cajun music. Our final number is going to be the Dixieland Jazz Funeral, and if anything really sounds like old New Orleans, this number we think will be quite spectacular. We're also pleased to be playing for the first time Cajun folk songs, a very peppy, unusual piece, and again, several Brazilian pieces, and you will hear a lot of South American influence. And Jason has really, really worked hard to come up with a wonderful rendition of Second Suite as our closing number. And it has a lot of Latin influence in it also.
Are there guest vocalists, or is it just music? Just instruments?
Instrument music. Mm-hmm. And what we're excited about is that, thanks to the crew of Olympus, really working hard, because this is their absolute busiest time of year, but they agreed to take some time out and join us.
Oh,
and
wow,
this will
yes.
also be a visual experience, more so than a lot of concerts we've had in the past.
And exciting for us, because within the memory of one of our oldest members, who goes back, like, we've been around 38 years, and he was King 4 or something, this may be the first time that we've ever performed live music.
So we're making history here on stage.
How about
and we want
that?
Everyone to come join us.
So let's go down to who, what, when, all that jazz.
All righty.
Who is?
The Houston Pride Band, with our special guest, the crew of Olympus.
And what are we talking about?
We are talking about our winter concert called Carnival.
When is it?
It is this Thursday, January 25th.
That's coming up. That's like in 3 days.
In 3 days at 7:30 p.m. And what are you going to ask me next?
Where?
And it is at the place we like to call home, where we also have our rehearsals. That is RMCC, Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church, at 2025 West 11th Street, or you might want to refer to it as the corner of T.C. Jester and 11th.
And okay, we always ask, what if people are interested in joining your organization? What do they do?
We would love to have you. We meet every Wednesday at the Activity Center, in, or if you want to call it the gym, at RMCC. And we rehearse at 7:30. New members are always welcome to attend. We are primarily wind and percussion instruments. We also have a lady, a phenomenal keyboardist, that we're pleased to have her in the entire concert for the first time. And it's really making a difference in our music. But if you haven't played for a while, if you sold your saxophone for cocktail money a few years ago, we can maybe help you out. And we even have...
We can get you a saxophone.
We have one of our members works really hard on making sure you have something decent to play. So, and if you want to come beat some pots and pans and you don't feel like you have musical experience, come talk to us. I'm sure there's a place for you. Remember, if you can beat it or blow it, you belong in a band.
I bet you have a website.
Yes, it's HoustonPrideBand.org. And please check us out. You'll see some pictures of members. You'll see all the propaganda on our upcoming concert and the rest of our season.
We want to thank Troy Villamont and Bill O'Rourke for telling us about Houston Pride Band's winter concert Carnival. That's this Thursday at RMCC. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Oh,
was Tommy Johns from his album Heading Into Tomorrow with a song called Hate Is Not a Family Value. And he's one of the artists who consider themselves a bear artist. And I was telling Jack before the show, my next Queer Music Heritage next month, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be about music of the bear community. And that covers the waterfront.
This is Queer Voices. This is Tom Robinson reminding you that you're either listening to, discovering for the first time, or tuned right in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine with Lucia Chappell and Greg Gordon.
Coming up, we'll talk to the legal champion for a new kind of Canadian family. But before there could be a new Canadian family, the fight for Canadian marriage equality had to be won.
A marriage made in Canada, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Kevin Barasa and Joe Varnell made human rights history as the first legally married same-gender couple in North America. Events surrounding their January 2001 Canadian marriage created a media frenzy in North America, South America, Europe, and Asia. They authored a book titled Just Married, which chronicles their journey toward legal marriage. It describes how they and their church, the Metropolitan Community Church of Toronto, challenged Canadian marriage laws. Their fight wasn't easy, but they proved that a strong will for positive change can produce just that. They shared their personal victory with all same-gender couples throughout Canada, and with their public appearances since then, in speeches, rallies, fundraisers, and parades, Kevin and Joe inspire hope for marriage equality everywhere. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. You can also demonstrate your solidarity by taking part in an online benefit auction. Look for the This Way Out area at alternabid.com. Again, to find out more about special CD thank you gifts, subscriptions, and the auction, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA.
Ontario, Canada's highest court rang in the new year with a new perspective on the definition of family. The long-term lesbian partner of a five-year-old boy's biological mother had sought legal recognition as the child's third parent rather than going through an adoption process that would rob the couple's sperm donor friend of his parental rights. A lower court ruled that it would be contrary to the child's best interest to deprive him of the legal parentage of one of his mothers, and the appeals court agreed. While the decision declared that social conditions and attitudes have changed, the Institute for Canadian Values denounced what it called the naked judicial activism of a court bent on entrenching alternative family structures outside of the legislative process. This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching spoke this week with lead attorney Jennifer Mathers about the case and its ramifications.
Jennifer is, are you based in London or Toronto? Or
I am based in Toronto.
Okay, Toronto-based lawyer who was involved in the three-parent case, which we've all been reading a bit about the last couple of weeks. So maybe what I could ask you to do, just for people who haven't been reading the newspaper, is to just describe the background of the case, who the people are, and what exactly they were seeking.
Sure, absolutely. We had a family that was located in London, Ontario. And it was two women, a lesbian couple, who decided to have a child. And in order to do that, they enlisted the biological assistance of one of their family friends. And when, after the child was born, the non-biological mom went to court to get a declaration of her parental status under the Children's Law Reform Act, which is a 1970s Ontario statute that was designed in part to eliminate the difference between legitimate and illegitimate children. Before that had been done. And she went to court and asked to be declared the mother of her child. And the lower court judge, this was before I was involved in the case, basically said that it was clear that it was in the best interest of this child to have all of his parents involved in his life, because the normal way that she might have gone about it would be to adopt her child, which not only is a bit offensive because she's adopting her own child, but it also means that the biological father would no longer be recognized as a parent, which for some people may be fine. For this family, it was not, because it wasn't a reflection of the reality that they were living.
I'm just curious about what the nature of the argument was.
It was sort of twofold. I mean, one, non-biological parents who are in a same-sex relationship are far more frequently caught by this problem, because we had some evidence to indicate that in a heterosexual couple, the non-biological parent would simply be registered on the birth certificate without questions being asked. If a heterosexual couple used a sperm donor, for example, the intensive father, who was not biologically connected to the child, would simply be registered. And then, you know, similar to this mother here, for all intents and purposes, would be the father of that child. And could get legal status that way without having to go to court. So we said that. And then also said, sort of made the more basic practical argument, is that there is a disproportionate impact on the queer community, because, you know, it's a biological sort of necessity that same-sex families involve a third party in procreation more often, far more often, than heterosexual couples do. And because of that, their choices are much more limited in the structuring of their families, because the law is not designed to reflect a family that doesn't fit the traditional mold as it was understood to be when the legislation was written.
So no doubt you had some religious opposition to this.
We did. In fact, they were the only opponents in the case at the appellate level. The Ontario government opted not to get involved, so the only true respondent in the case, since all of our parents were on the same side, was the Interfaith Coalition of Marriage and Family.
And what did they argue?
They argued that this would be a slippery slope, that if we were prepared to, you know, if we were prepared to grant status to three parents, why not five or six? If we were prepared to grant status to this woman, why not step-parents? Why not neighbors? Why not grandparents who are involved in children's lives? That sort of thing. And I think, I certainly don't want to misstate, but I think that the crux of their argument was, you know, if not these people, then why, if, you know, why not everyone else?
And how did you guys respond to them?
I think a couple of different ways. One was that this is the case before the court, and it has to be decided on its own facts, and not on the basis of speculation as to what might come as a result of it. And two, that if a step-parent wants to make an argument, if a grandmother wants to make an argument, if a neighbor wants to make an argument that their human dignity is being impacted by not being recognized as a parent of a child, then they can make that argument. But I think that it's reasonable to say that there is a difference between a person who is in the position of deciding to have a child with his or her spouse, you know, being involved in the conception of that child, being involved in the birth of that child, being involved in that child's day-to-day life from the moment that it's born, and being that child's parent for every practical reason, and not to have access to and the protection of the legal status of parent. And there is a difference between that person, a spouse who cannot have the recognition vis-a-vis her own child, compared to someone who comes into a child's life later who may be very important. But to suggest that it's the exact same relationship, I think, is a bit offensive.
Mm-hmm. So tell me again what the judge said. You were explaining how he came to the decision to allow the three parents to all be parents. What was that called again?
Parents patriae.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically means that the court determined that, as the lower court did for that matter, that it was in the best interest of this child to have his mother recognized in law, that it was in the best interest of this child to have her recognized in this way, as opposed to through a much more onerous adoption procedure that would exclude his biological father, and that the court was capable of making that declaration because there was a gap in the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
They said that when the Children's Law Reform Act was written, and they did certainly use the words the mother, but the legislature didn't do that with some sort of purposeful intention of excluding same-sex families. But it was simply done because at that time same-sex marriage was not on the horizon. Even social acceptance of same-sex relationships was not on the horizon to the degree that it is now. Various reproductive technologies that are now commonplace were not even thought about then, and the legislature simply didn't turn their mind to the possibility that using the word mother was not simply a statement of fact.
Mm-hmm. So now if this applies specifically to this family, does it provide any kind of relief to other parents that might be thinking of going through the same process, or is this going to be one of those things that's just going to have to perpetually be fought on a case-by-case basis?
I mean, I think that no matter what, it will always be fought on a case-by-case basis, because anything that has to do with children and certainly any kind of declaration of parental status will be made on the basis of the fact before the court. So any parent will have to make an application to be declared a parent, and the court will have to evaluate that in some way, and you know, only time will tell how the courts go about doing that in the face of this decision. But I think certainly it provides other families who are similarly situated a precedent to rely upon and to say, you know, this declaration is available and there is no reason in the world why the court can't give it to us.
Mm-hmm. Is there any possibility of appeal, or is this it for you guys now?
Well, we haven't heard anything yet. It may be. It's a strange case, like I said, because the government wasn't involved, so our only opponent was an intervener, and interveners have a hard time trying to take cases forward on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what they will attempt to do, but we haven't heard anything about an appeal thus far.
That was Canadian Attorney Jennifer Mathers speaking with This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching. The case of Ontario's two moms and a dad family could soon become a model for other countries, as governments around the world are being challenged to accommodate the expanding definition of families headed by gay and lesbian couples. Swedish activists are already pointing out the inadequacy of the two-parent limit implied in the government's proposal to extend full parental rights to the partner of a lesbian impregnated through the use of a foreign sperm bank or private donor arrangements. The birth mother would automatically have custody of the child, while her partner would be legally recognized as the co-parent. Swedish law already extends that right to a lesbian co-parent when her partner becomes pregnant with the help of the public health service. The proposed amendments would also give children born from donated sperm or eggs the legal right to genetic information. The Swedish Federation for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Rights has welcomed the proposal, but still stresses that children born into lesbi-gay families frequently have parental caretakers that extend beyond one birth mother and one birth father. Welcome to the 21st century. For that lucky 5-year-old Canadian boy and his three loving parents, here's singer-songwriter Susie Nash to shake things up with Rainbow Sprinkles.
Shake, 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 some rainbow sprinkles. Shake, 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 them all around. Shake, 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 some rainbow sprinkles pouring down. Shake them over here, throw your hands in the air. Shake them with the friends, sprinkles everywhere. Red and orange, yellow, green and blue. Shake.
Rainbow Sprinkles, the title cut from a lovely collection of songs for the children of lesbian gay families by Susie Nash. You can find information about her CD at rainbowsprinklesonline.com.
There's nothing so international as a powerful idea. Hi, I'm Edmund White. While I live in Paris and have worked in many cities in the U.S., it is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful and impressive over the past couple of decades. And one radio program, This Way Out, has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine on this station.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Don Lupo, Rex Walker with Phil Kelly, Graham Underhill, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Dustin Richardson, and Heather Kitching contributed program material. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from you, our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some very special CD thank you gifts, too. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WMNF Tampa, Florida, 3OCR Colac, Victoria, KXCI Tucson, Arizona, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
I need to break this off. Our six-month affair, our fling, our tryst, our liaison, our thing. And it's not because you have a boyfriend and I'm feeling caught, nor because I want to be your boyfriend. That's a scary thought. It's just that you've crushed that feeling of trust in our tryst by adding another object of lust to your list. It used to be just your boyfriend or me, but recently I learned you have your pick of your boyfriend, me, or Rick. The other woman. I'm not too happy in this role. The other woman. It never was a lifelong goal. I'm fine just being a slut, but be demoted to substitute slut. The other woman. I'm sorry, I can't make that leap. The other woman. mean there's cheap, and then there's cheap. I thought I could take it in stride, try. But your entree comes with only one side. The other, other woman. I guess I'm just an old-fashioned guy. Arrangement was pretty nice, meeting every Saturday at 3. While your boyfriend was in therapy, probably dealing with issues of fidelity. And what arrangement do you have now? It must be some brilliant piece of shtick, some ingenious trick. On the day or days when you get dick, sorry, Rick. Call me a buddy daddy, because I won't agree to play the understudy, especially since it's not for pay. So now it's time that you find another insignificant other. You'll miss it. Kiss it. Goodbye.
I'm really glad I got to share that with you all.
Yes, that's really amazing.
The artist singing was Michael Winther, and it's from a Broadway, or off Broadway musical called Songs from an Unmade Bed, and it's from like last year. It's from like last year. Good English, JD. And it's very clever. It's not your trite musical songs, as you just heard. The Other Woman, very clever lyrics all the way through. I'm very pleased with that soundtrack.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So it's not running then, probably?
No, I don't believe so.
Wow, it'd be great if they can bring it to Houston.
Joe Watts told me about it, so maybe he's thinking about it. It would take the right vocalist to pull this off.
Yeah.
It's one singer all the way through. And I don't know if there's little scenes between the songs. I have no idea. But
it's only one singer?
One singer.
Oh, wow.
And it's like
so you have to be
18 songs. You got to be good.
Wow.
You got to be really good to pull this off.
It's not a one-act play, I mean, one-person play, is it? Of course, you don't know.
No, I can't tell enough from here.
Well, it's... And so you found that out from Joe Watts.
Mm-hmm. I heard about it from him.
He's done a lot of plays.
He knows what musicals are around.
Right. Well, okay. We wanted to talk. Well,
you were going to talk about the Marshals, Grand Marshals.
Yeah, Grand Marshals. There is not much time for it because I guess they compressed it a little bit this year. But for nomination of Grand Marshals for Pride, the Pride Parade this year, go to pridehouston.org and there's a form there. It has to be filled out and sent in by a short time, and then they will go through it with all the previous Grand Marshals and make sure everything is okay. You also have to get the signature of the person you're nominating, so that
they have to agree,
right? So that they will serve if they win.
Because there have been people that we thought, boy, he or she should be Grand Marshal, and then they were approached and said, no, I don't want to do that.
Right, and you know,
that's up to them.
Exactly, right. So yeah, you don't want to elect somebody who just isn't into it or can't be in town or whatever. Also, the other thing that happened this week is the Houston Voice has closed shop.
Oh, after how many years?
It's like 25, 30 years. It's a long time. It was known as, the Montrose Star at one time. And it's had a couple different owners. I mean, Henry McClurg owned it for a number of years. Then there are a few other people. In fact, Deborah was editor at one time, Deborah Bell. And there was a number of different people involved in it, and most recently it was bought out by Window Media, which is the...
They own The Blade and The Southern Voice and probably others.
Great newspapers, and somehow they took it from a weekly to make it sort of a monthly, sort of a twit-type thing, which means it was more of a bar guide, and they were trying to emphasize the web, and It all just didn't work, and it's really unfortunate that Houston can't support a weekly newspaper. Dallas can. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that Outsmart is such a good publication that it sort of skims off the top.
I call it Junior Advocate.
And it's, but it's not a newspaper.
Not so much news, but
and they admit it's not a newspaper, but they somehow get the higher, like the people who are advertising houses and real estate and things like that. And the bars just don't really advertise here in Houston. And the major bar owner doesn't, advertise especially that much. So they just didn't seem to be able to get the advertising dollars in the publication. So it just couldn't be supportive, which is really sad that a city this large
can't do it, right?
Can't have a weekly newspaper. And I know, that the Gem, there's a couple other bar rags out there, but there isn't really a solid newspaper that reports stories. And I think we've all been critical of The Voice over the years, that it should have been better, should have been this, especially when you can, compare it to things like the Dallas Voice, or I guess it's Windy City Times in Chicago.
And the Washington Blade.
Washington Blade, or even the Southern Voice. That, why doesn't Houston have this? And
New York struggled for years and years to maintain a weekly newspaper. And I guess it has one or two now, but for a long time it didn't.
Well, I think they have the
Native.
The Native, or became the, and I may be mistaken about this, but I think Windows Media had a publication up there, and it may have been the New York edition of the Blade or something like that. I honestly don't know. But, of course, in New York you also have the Village Voice, which it's not a gay newspaper, but definitely is a strong alternative. Although, if you've been listening to stories either on Democracy Now! Or on NPR, the Village Voice is not what it used to be. I mean, media's really changing because of the consolidation, and certainly...
And the Internet.
And the Internet. I mean, there's a lot of good things about the Internet, and these blogs are great and stuff like that, but, the actual reporting of the news stories, not the slanted, but...
How many blogs do you read?
I don't really read that. I read some media stuff.
I don't read any.
We're
not typical.
Yes, we're not.
And we're well informed anyhow.
And I'm a person who gets a newspaper, and I still like to read the newspaper. And as much as I will pull it up on the web sometimes and things like that, it's just I like to have the newspaper. We're out of time.
I want to thank our guests from the Pride Band, and stay tuned for Queer Music Heritage.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Inside and spread it around the heartland. Say a prayer, there'll be a bit of rain. And when the snow falls, smothering the wheat fields, remember that the green will come again. And when fear rolls heavy like a storm cloud, and thunder is a threatening sound, just reach for the light that's deep inside and spread it around in the spring night. Take a deep breath. And in the summer, I'm looking for a ride. In the fall, it's all about the leaving. And in the winter, I stay inside.
This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and welcome to my 7th anniversary show. I'm celebrating with what I think is a very special show, honoring the work of Trett Fury. Now, she should not be a new name to you, as she's been recording since 1972 and has broken her own new ground in a number of ways. And one of the ways that impresses me is that in the early 1970s in L.A., when she was making her musical beginnings, she also realized that she needed more control over her sound and became one of the first women sound engineers in the U.S. That led to her working with Olivia Records and a number of artists, including Chris Williamson. They became musical and life partners and were almost the poster children of gay relationships until Trett again needed to go her own way. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Stick around and you'll hear Trett talk about her career and her music. And the music starting the show came from her latest CD, Anytime, Anywhere, from 2005. We'll be back to that album later in the show. I got a chance to sit down with Trett early last November, prior to seeing her in concert in Houston. You got some really great exposure very early in your career with Spencer Davis. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I had recently moved to L.A., trying to find my fame and fortune, and I had met and was partnered with June Millington, who at the time was a guitar player for a group called Fanny. And Fanny was the first all-women rock and roll band in the early 70s, and quite well established. And I moved in with June. We lived up in the Hollywood Hills, and right around the corner from us was where Spencer Davis lived, and he knew the keyboard player, the piano player from Fanny, and was looking for a guitar player. So I auditioned for him, and he hired me on the spot. He wasn't intending on hiring a woman, but he loved the way I played. And he wasn't doing his old, the Spencer Davis group rock and roll stuff. He was doing blues, acoustic blues. And at the time, I was playing a lot of 12-string slide, lead belly style, finger picking, 12-string slide, 6-string slide. And he just loved the way I played. So I worked with him. I brought in a bass player who was a friend of mine. We became a trio. I wrote some stuff that he recorded, as did the bass player. And I worked with him for, I want to say, about a year, I think, at which point the manager of Fanny saw my talent working with Spencer and took me on as an artist and got me my first record deal with MCA Records. And so I stopped working with Spencer. I did work with him again in the mid-70s. He was doing a retro band, a retro rock and roll thing, and I played guitar with him again, but it wasn't as much fun. I was having to sing songs like Gimme Some Lovin' and I'm a Man. Singing back about I'm a Man was a little trying for me. but it was great exposure, and it was good work for me.
In 1972, Spencer Davis released an album called Mousetrap. He recorded one of your songs, and I believe you played and sang backups on it, though that's not credited on the album.
It's not. Well, who knows? In those days, they weren't as meticulous about crediting stuff. It really was, I mean, in a lot of ways, it was really almost a duo album, but it was never set up that way. But I wrote the single for the album, and I did all the guitar work and all the backup singing.
I should have phrased it as harmony singing, because the vocals were very strong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was more than just backup vocals, right. It was harmony, because we sang together through all the shows and all the stuff we did.
That album contains one of your songs, Rainy Season. That song also appears on your own debut album in 1973.
A very interesting song. I mean, it was one of my first, and not my first songs, but one of the first songs that I thought had some potential. I don't even know where it came from. You know, I listen to those old songs and I think, oh my God, do I really want anyone to ever hear them again?
It sounded different on your album.
It did, and when I did it with Spencer, it was more of like a country, kind of a country folk piece. And then when I did it with Lowell George, who produced my first album, he took it in a whole different direction, a la Little Feet. And it was much, much hipper and much, much more avant-garde than the way it was done with Spencer. So they're two totally different takes on the same song. And it's not, to me, it's not one of my best songs. It's not something that I would listen to.
Well, for historical purposes, let's hear just a bit of both versions of the song Rainy Season.
What's gonna happen when the rainy season comes? Will your roof cave in on you? Will the rain come pouring through and the lightning blind your view? What's gonna happen when it's cold once again? Will you wear that ragged hat or stay in with a cat? Although I can't quite picture that. What's gonna happen when I leave once again? For the winter's almost here. All the grass is fading, life's parading, freezes for a while. What's gonna happen when your patience finally fails? Will you lock yourself away or hide for several days and come out feeling great?
Understand you were one of the first female sound engineers. How did that come about?
Well, I was working on my second solo album. I was working with a company called Heritage Music. It was Johnny Mercer's son had started a record company, and I was working with a producer by the name of Morgan Cabot, whose claim to fame was The Captain and Tennille. He had produced their first album, their first big hit album. I was working with a young engineer who turned out to be my mentor and a great friend. But when I first started working with him, he had the attitude that a lot of engineers have of being a bit of arrogance, like, you can't possibly understand what I'm doing, and I'm not going to explain anything that I'm doing to you because this is my secret. And I don't like working that way. So I said, you know, I don't like feeling ignorant. I'd like to learn a little bit more about what's going on in the studio. So the studio owner gave me a book called Modern Recording Techniques, which was like the Bible of recording in the 70s. I took it home and read it, and I understood it. And I came back the next day, and I started explaining things to Randy, my engineer, and he was like, whoa. And he was a musician who came at engineering from a musician's point of view, as I pretty much did. But I could explain things to him that he did instinctively but didn't understand. So he says, you want to work as my second engineer? And I said, absolutely. So when we weren't working on my album, I was working with him on other projects. And we worked 18-hour days, 7 days a week. You know, for a year and a half, I worked with him. Through that time, my album was sold to United Artists, but it was never released because United Artists decided, or Transamerica Life Insurance, who owned United Artists, decided to get out of the music business. So my album got dropped, and fortunately, I had the background of engineering to fall back on while I was struggling to get another deal. And I spent the next 5 years pretty much in the studio, supporting myself as a recording engineer and using all my profits, all my income, you know, disposable income on bands, putting bands together and showcasing all over L.A., trying to get the next big deal. So it was really fortuitous because, you know, so many artists have to wait tables, have to, you know, work as a clerk in the supermarket, whatever, to make ends meet until you can get your next big break. But I never had to leave. Once I started, I never had to leave the music industry. And I became a pretty well-known engineer. It was hard because in the 70s, of course, you know, women couldn't possibly know what they were doing in a studio. And every session I did, every new client I had to prove myself. I had to prove that I knew what I was doing, that I knew more than they did. And it was always a struggle, but I never lost a client because once people started working with me, they realized that I had a good ear and I had a good temperament and I was easy to work with.
On your first album, there was involvement with Bonnie Raitt, Van Dyke Parks, The Millingtons, Lowell George of Little Feet. That's pretty heady stuff.
Yeah. And they were all, you know, they were all friends of mine. We were all hanging out in the early 70s. Lowell I met through June. And when it was time, when I got my deal with MCA, I wanted him to be my producer. They balked at first, but they, you know, they went for it because he had a good, strong name. And he had, I believe I was his first outside production outside of Little Feet. And he was a friend of Van Dyke's. And I met Van Dyke through him. And Van Dyke and I became friends. And Bonnie also through June. We all hung out in those days. There was a lot of great... In the house where I lived, there was a lot of music going on. Crazy Horse used to rehearse down in the basement, Neil Young's band. Bonnie would come over and Lowell would come over and we'd play music and Freebo would come around and Joel Tepp, a harp player. I mean, there was so much stuff going on in those days. Danny O'Keefe. I mean, we were all good friends. We all played music together. I remember singing one night with Maria Muldera and Linda Ronstadt and Bonnie and I were singing backup, just like hanging out at a party, just singing. And I used to play fiddle a bit in the early days and Maria always encouraged me to on my fiddle playing. So those were really, really great, very heady times, you know, and it was a great time to be in music. That's when record companies really pretty much, some record companies supported artists, took artists on to let them mature and grow and just give you a one-shot deal. So there was, you know, there was great stuff going on in those days.
Tell me about your early connection with June Millington.
Well, I met her in 1970. I had just moved to L.A. I went to New York to find a manager when I dropped out of school and I decided I was going to pursue music. I went to New York and to play the Village, to play the Hoots, to see if I could find a manager. And I met this woman, Maggie Corey, who was Professor Irwin Corey's daughter. And her claim to fame, though, was that she was an ex-partner of James Taylor's and that she knew everybody in the business and she wanted to manage me. So I said, sure, let's try it. And immediately moved to L.A. And she had just gotten to know Fanny. Can't even remember how. I think it was through a studio and through a man named John Fishbeck, who was a friend of James's. And she brought me over to their house one night. And I met June. We started playing guitar together, and that was it. I never left. We just kind of fell in love, and musically and personally, and that was really my first lesbian relationship. And we ended up spending 2.5 years together, and didn't really play music together because it was all about Fanny in those days. And you know, we would play acoustic guitars together when we were home, but she mostly wasn't home. She was mostly on the road, which is why I eventually left, because I never saw her. She was always gone. But through her, I met a lot of people and went on to have, you know, my own career.
How did you make the transition from the big labels like MCA and Uni to Olivia?
Well, I got pretty frustrated. It's, you know, the music industry is very political, and it's also, it's a very sexist industry. It always has been, and it still is. More so you see it in Nashville now than in L.A., but you know, I lost my deal with Uni through politics. The president who brought me into the label was fired, and all the artists that came with that president were dropped. Had nothing to do with talent. It had all to do with, you know, who you knew and or who you were sleeping with. And then when I lost my deal with United Artists through the label folding, I was really getting tired of it, and I hooked up with June Millington again after several years of absence. I decided I would produce her next album, which was called Heart Song, and I sold it to Olivia Records. And I met the women from Olivia, and they offered me a contract, and I realized that even though I didn't really want to be pigeonholed into something called women's music, here was a ready-made audience of, at the time, thousands of women who were hungry for women artists, who appreciated everything you did. And I could have total creative control over what I did, and I didn't have to sign any kind of long-term agreements. So it was a natural progression for me. And when I hooked up then with Chris Williamson through June, I became her opening act, which later, you know, developed into a duo act. But at the time, I was her opening act, and it was, you know, I was really the first sort of rock and roll singer on Olivia. I was actually on Second Wave because Olivia was trying to stay pure, women-only folk-based artists. And they started Second Wave Records to bring in more other kinds of music and women who might have worked with men and all that kind of stuff. So I was the first artist on Second Wave Records, but it felt like a natural progression. There was such beauty in those rooms and such energy of, you know, thousands and thousands of women at the time just loving the music. And they didn't always love my music because my music was a little loud for a lot of the women. You know, they'd just say, "We want Chris. Get off stage. You're too loud." And it's like, you're going to have to listen.
Your second solo album, Terminal Hold, was released in 1984 on Olivia Records' Second Wave label. From it, please tell me about the song, As If by the Wind.
Well, As If by the Wind is, you know, that was the time of, that was the early 80s. And the whole way that song, I love the way that song starts, because you hear that intro in just about every third song in the 80s, the way it kind of bump, the way the guitars build. It was a love song that I had written for somebody I had known in the 70s working in the studios. It was a relationship that wasn't supposed to be happening. It's one of those things that just happens. My songs are all very personal. They come from different places in my life and different places I've been, and I've been in a lot of places, a lot of romantic situations, a lot of environmental situations. You know, I've been all over the map, and it's all through my music.
I caught a glimpse of you that opened my eyes. I caught a fever quite by surprise. I stole a glance that shook me inside.
Fourth solo album came out in 1990, called Time Turns the Moon. And one of the songs that really caught my attention from it is The Girls All Dance.
Well, that was from my high school years. Growing up in small town northern Michigan, going to the Berriga dance every Friday night. And the boys never danced. They just stand around in a big circle, and so the girls all danced with each other. And And I thought, when I started writing this, I was like, this is perfect. This is the, you know, the lesbians are going to love this because we all do dance now. But it came from a place in high school where, and it was always amazing to me, rarely did you see a boy on the dance floor. And it was okay to dance with girls. There was nothing you know, wrong with that in high school because you were just dancing. And it's been a great song. Women love that song.
I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your time with Chris Williamson, because that was such a very public part of your life and music career.
Yes, it was. It was. We were together personally and professionally for 19 years. And as I mentioned, I met her as an engineer on her children's record, Lumiere, and became her producer over the next 19 years, basically. I started as an opening act for her. She'd play in my sets, I'd play in her sets. Through the course of that first decade, we didn't really talk about our relationship. We sort of kept it private, but it became more and more public. And by the early 90s, people knew that we were a couple. Our music became more and more closely aligned. We started writing more together. I was going less rock, more folk, and she was more going from folk to a little more rock. And so it was a nice blending of styles and talent. And our voices were so beautifully matched that sometimes you couldn't tell one from the other. And that was something that people loved and we loved. And but the more our relationship became public, the more people sort of fell to us as role models. And comes a point, I think, in anyone's professional life where if you become too identified with someone else, you lose your own identity. And I felt like I was starting to lose my own identity and my own creative control by being just a duo with Chris, because it was always Chris and Trett. And I was feeling like and Trett more than I was feeling like Trett. And I just had to step away, but it was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made personally and professionally, because I knew that there would be a lot of backlash. I knew that I would not have the following that Chris would continue to have. And I knew that people would be resentful. And they were. I mean, I struggled for the first 2 or 3 years were really hard. It was hard to get work. People were nasty to me. Not everybody, but certain elements. And I'd get emails from people saying, you can't leave. You need to stay together for us. You're our role models. You know, you're the perfect couple. How could you leave?
You were on a relationship pedestal.
Yeah, exactly. The poster children for codependency. And it just was wrong. We should have never, put ourselves out there so much like that, because it just made it very difficult to move on. But it was a great run. It was a great 19 years. We had a great relationship, both professionally and personally, but it had run its course in my life. I had to move on. There's still people that won't come to my shows because they take sides. And there should never have been a side, and there shouldn't be sides.
Do you currently have much contact with Chris?
Yes. I mean, not much. We see each other at events. We were both at Michigan last year. I as a vendor, her as a performer. I saw her recently in P-Town. But we don't have a lot of contact. It's interesting because most lesbians, when they break up, they remain friends. Well, that's not the case with Chris, and I probably will never be. I think it's just still too hard. And it's harder on her, I think. So we don't have a lot of contact, but I don't think we will do any kind of reunion show like people always want. It's just not. It's not where I am, and it's not where she is either.
One more question about when you worked together. How did you work out the creative process? Who sang lead? Who recorded?
Well, when we first started writing together, I would write more of the music and she would write more of the lyrics, because I'm naturally much more musically inclined, and she is more lyrically inclined. She would have a piece of lyric, and I would say, oh, and I've got the perfect melody for that. And a lot of the earlier stuff, she would sing the lead, or we would sing it together, or we would share verses, or we would alternate verses. A lot of the stuff we did, like Helen's Field, Stones from Helen's Field, things like that, we would alternate verses. As we continued to write, we started writing more integrated. We would share lyrical ideas, we would share musical ideas, and we were teaching songwriting a lot. And the more we would teach songwriting, we would always ended up writing songs. That the lessons that we were teaching, we'd end up writing great songs ourselves. And those songs were probably more closely aligned in terms of having an equal share in the whole creative process of music and lyric. You know, it's hard to say who took the lead. I guess it depended on who felt more closely aligned to the lyric and to the feel of the song.
Of the three albums that you did together, are there any songs that stand out that you're particularly proud of?
Oh boy, I think the Stones from Helen's Field is a great song. Radio Quiet was one of our favorites always. Those are two that really stand out to me, Stones from Helen's Field and Radio Quiet.
Let's take a break and hear a little of their song, Radio Quiet. It's the title track from their 1998 album.
There are places on the earth that are so quiet. You can hear the whispers of space. We stand beneath the stars and the heavens, and we search the chaos for a face. Between the heartbeats, a place beneath the strings, a dream of other heartbeats, a silhouette unseen. We listen for the whispers, for any sign at all. The radio is quiet, we're waiting for the call.
Again, I wish I could play full versions of all of the songs on this show. But hopefully, this will give you a taste of the music and Trett's career, and you'll seek out her releases.
This is Trett Fury, and you are listening to Queer Music Heritage.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along by looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more Very Queer programming,
Please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Since your breakup with Chris, you've released three excellent solo albums. The first, in 2001, was called Back Home. From it, please tell us about the song All Over Town.
All Over Town. Wow, that was the song I wrote right after, as I was leaving, pretty much as I was leaving Chris. And it was a song of hope that we could get to a place where we could see each other. I'll find you in the schoolyard. I'll pass you in the underground and wonder how we ever, found our way back home. And my hope is that we could find our way back to really what was a basis of our relationship, which was a very strong friendship. And we have that friendship, but it's a very distant friendship right now. And this, just the phrase All Over Town was that it was. Everybody was talking about it. It was on the streets before I even knew it. People were, oh, something's up. Some people came up to me and said they knew when we recorded Radio Quiet that something wasn't quite right. People had their senses of that something was wrong even before I realized that something was tragically wrong with where I was at in that relationship. And I think it's a neat song.
The time I still remember from a place that I could never forget. It's a piece of broken pottery from a veil of deep regret. It's the sound of voices in the waves, it's the sound of sea on sea. It's the beat of all creation, it's the heart of you.
Over Town was about the breakup. From the same album was the song This Train.
That was my leaving. That was my metaphor. Well, I always say, that was my return to folk, my true return to a folk album, and you can't do a folk album without a train song. And that was my train song. But it really, I wrote that as I was leaving the West Coast. I lived on the West Coast for 30 years. I was in L.A. for 17 years. I was in Oregon for 13 years. And I decided to come back home, come back to the Midwest. And in doing so, I drove a Ryder truck across country with taking basically just my studio and a few things I owned and pulling my car. And it was about leaving Leading the West and Never Turning Back, and it's a song about moving forward and never turning back.
This train only runs on a runaway track. Once you head east, there's no turning back. Once you're on board, you can ride for days. Till the evening fog and the morning haze. There's no getting off once you're on the rail. Come to win and come to fail. The big wheels rumble through the floor.
That was This Train from the Back Home album. And your next album, My Shoes, had an important title track.
That was a song I felt I had to write. I really, really was tired of people saying that I blithely walked away, you know, from a relationship, and how could I have done that? And not realizing that how difficult it is. And I, you know, it is the most difficult thing. It's as difficult to be the one who leaves as it is to be the one who's left. And I always say that. And it's true, you know, and people know it. But people tend to judge you. And it's a song about being judged and that you should not judge someone until you've walked a mile in their shoes. And it's been a very powerful song for me. It's really turned people around to say, oh my God, this must have been hard for you. Hello. You know, and part of the problem was when I left, Chris and I had a whole spring tour, and she got the tour, and I had no work, and so she was out there talking about what happened from her point of view, and people only could hear one side of the story, and I said, this is crazy. I'm writing my side of the story of what it's like to be the one who has to leave.
Have you ever had to walk away from someone you had promised your whole life to? And have you ever had to face your fears, bear the tears, wonder if you'd ever get it right? Have you ever had to close your eyes? Have you ever had to realize that nothing lasts forever in a day? Well, I've done what must be done. I've chased the moon and the sun. Have you ever had to do what I have done? Everybody has an answer. Everybody takes a side. Everybody has a ticket on this never-ending ride. And the old adage is true. Until you've walked a mile in my shoes, you don't know, but I do.
I think My Shoes has been an important song for me in terms of, and for other people in terms of the recognition of how difficult it is to be a person who leaves a long-term relationship. It's helped a lot of people, I think, through the process of dealing with that breakup, and also that song has been used a lot in therapy and divorce therapy and other kinds of therapy. I think it's a, you know, very well done song.
How has your music changed over the years?
Oh, it's gotten much, I'm much more folk influenced than I ever was. Well, except in my early years. I mean, I came from folk. I moved into pop rock. I moved in from folk rock to pop rock. There was a couple years of punk and new wave in there as well. But I've just mellowed, and I've mellowed back into the acoustic guitar. You know, some of it is survival. You can't travel these days if you're going to fly at all. You can't travel with a lot of instruments, and I can't afford to travel with a band. You know, my first and most important instrument is the acoustic guitar, and it's just a natural place for me to be. So I write only these days on the acoustic guitar, and the more I travel in the folk worlds, which I'm doing a lot more these days, the more I find my influences and my inspiration comes from other folk artists, that other storytellers that I love. Because I go to the North American Folk Alliance every year, which is a huge folk conference. But it's become the highlights of every year, and I hear new folk artists. I learn things from other players and singers, and I find that it takes me back into myself and where my roots were and where I started. I write a lot of story songs. I write a lot of love songs, but they're really, really more folk influenced than anything these days.
Has your audience changed?
Well, my audience grows with me. My audience is aging, as am I. I have younger people come to my shows. I'd like to see more, because I think my music is ageless, and I call my music rock and aggressive folk, because there's, you know, there's an edge to a lot of the stuff I do, and I think that younger a younger audience appreciates that. But I think my music is timeless. I hope it's timeless. But I look out, and you know, my audience is graying right along with me.
To me, the writing seems wiser, and I like that it's from an older perspective.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, especially the title song of my latest CD about being old, over 50, and still having it.
When you perform, what song gets the most audience reaction?
Right now, Anytime, Anywhere, which is that song, because people say, yeah, I'm over 50, yeah, I, you know. Yeah, that really, really, really gets a great response.
Tell me about that song.
Well, that song actually came from an experience that I had. I was at the National Women's Music Festival 3 years ago, and I was talking to Alex Olson and Pamela and Ember about joining the union, because I'm vice president of Local 1000, which is the first non-geographically based local of the AFM. And the thing that's great about this union is that for the first time ever, traveling folk musicians can look forward to a pension. We have an amazing pension plan. And as a traveling musician, you've never been able to have to get any kind of pension. So it's a great union. And I just believe in this union for many reasons. And I'm trying to get younger women into the union, especially women, because women historically have not had pensions, you know, have not taken care of themselves unless it's been through their husband, you know, and a lot of women don't think that. They still don't think that way. They don't think about retirement. And I want more women in this music, in this union, excuse me, because it's still mostly over 50 white male. So and I was talking to them about pension, and I realized that their eyes were just glazing over, and you know, they weren't really, they weren't thinking about pension plans. And I said to them, I know you're not thinking about pension now, but I said, believe me, it seems like only yesterday that I was in my 20s and I'm 52. And Alex Olson kind of turned to me and said, you're 52, you're hot. And I just, you know, how do you do it? And you know, I was like, what does that exactly mean? That you can't be hot over 50 is the way I took it. And she assures me that's not what she meant. But it spurred me to write that song. And I always say, I'm now 55, but I'm not dead. And it's about, you know, just because you're over 50 doesn't mean you're not, one, you're not having sex, that you can't be hot, that you're not, you know, you're not out there, that you're not passionate, that you're not emotional, that you're not always working on looking your best and being the best you can be. And women love that song. Women and men both love that song. It's a great song.
I'm an older woman now. It doesn't mean that I am dead. More than anything, it means I'm more alive inside my head. I'm not talking ethereal, 'cause we're physically bred. I can talk you in circles, and I can talk you into bed. 'Cause it only gets better, and it only gets smarter. It's sweet and it's sexy, it's softer and harder, and it's all about the comfort, and it's all about the dare. So I'll take you anytime, anywhere. I'm a married woman now. It doesn't mean that I am blind. There's so much more to see, but only one to take the time. I'm talking fidelity, 'cause we're physically fine. I can talk you in circles, and I talk because you're mine. 'Cause it only gets better, and it only gets smarter. It's sweet and it's sexy, it's softer and harder, and it's all about the comfort, and it's all about the dare. So I'll take you anytime, anywhere.
Of course, that was the title track from Tret's 2005 album, Anytime, Anywhere. I love the song Drivin'. Can you tell me about it?
Oh, that I wrote that for Jane. We were driving. She, for 5 years, she took a hiatus from the work that she does, which is hospital administration, to travel with me, to be my booking agent, to be my manager, to be my publicist, to travel with me and sell the clothes and the CDs. And it was a great run, you know, but she was ready to go back to the work that she loves. But we would drive endlessly. I mean, we'd put 50,000 miles a year on a car for 4 years, plus flying and renting cars. That was just our personal car. We'd put 50,000 miles. And we'd get in that car, and we would go. And she had bought me a baby Taylor so that I could write songs in the car, because we were always in the car, and I needed to write. So she bought me a little guitar so I could actually play, you know, without hitting her in the head with the neck of the guitar. And we were driving through the night, and we were just passing through Ohio into Kentucky, and I was working on a different song that just was not happening. And I was just about to put the guitar away when I just kind of was noodling around, and I found this chord, I found this sequence. I looked up at the sky, and there was a plane flying, and it was just this beautiful, beautiful night. It was like a Paris blue sky. And I just started singing the song, and she goes, "What was that?" And I said, "It's a new song. I just wrote it." And it was a 5-minute song, and it's all about her traveling with me.
It's a gorgeous night. There's a plane in the sky, and I'm driving with my girl by my side, and the moon is up, not a cloud to be seen. Is this an earthly delight or a heavenly dream? And I touch your arm to make sure you're real, but I'm not making this up. This is and the first star comes out, starlight, star bright. You're always the wish that I wish for each night. And the hours fly by like the telephone lines, and the radio's on, and we're keeping the time. And I touch your arm to make sure you're real, that I'm not faking this up. Yeah.
taken you out on a real long day, across the Ohio line, through the Kentucky maze. And though the sky is so dark, my heart is so light, and I touch your arm to make sure. That I'm not making this up. This is really how love feels. Ooh, ooh.
I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to especially thank Trek Theory for the wonderful interview. And, as I had expected, the interview was so good that I could not fit it into the radio version of this show, so my internet listeners could hear an extended version with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I've featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. To find out more about Trett and her music, please visit her excellent website at www.trettfury.com. I'm going to end this segment with one of my favorite of Trett's songs. It comes from the Radio Quiet album from 1998. One of your songs is called Tomboy Girl, and you've made sort of your own cottage industry out of that idea.
Yes, I have. Yeah. Well, I always, you know, when that song came out, women responded to it, women related to it, because so many of us grew up as tomboys. And, you know, so many of us still own that title, and proudly so. And so when I wrote that song about my own life growing up as a tomboy, with growing up with three brothers, I wanted to do a t-shirt. And in 2000, my partner Jane and I decided, well, let's try it. Let's do a t-shirt and see how it sells. And women loved it. And then we did a hat, and then we did a tank top, and then we started a web business. And people, we would say, give us your requests, we'll see what we can do. And it turned into a line of clothing. I took on another partner, a good friend of mine in Massachusetts, who became a very active part of the company. And Jane's dream was to start a retail store, and Carol's was as well. And so we eventually opened up a retail store in Madison. And now it's a retail business, a web business. I sell a lot of clothes at my shows. It's also my production company. The name is so tightly related to me now, that my record company is Tomboy Girl Records. My production company is Tomboy Girl. Our fest that we had did Tomboy Girl Fest for a couple years. It's just a name that's very closely associated with me, which is great. And the funny thing, you know, the interesting thing to me is, you know, on the road I sell a lot of clothes to my audience, but in my store in Madison, I sell mostly to middle school girls and straight girls, and mothers come in with their daughters, and the daughters want, they love the clothing because they love the name, they can own it now. There's no onus attached to it anymore, something to be proud of. You know, since Title IX, more and more so, it's okay to be a tomboy. It's okay to be in sports. And girls these days, you know, they're all soccer champs and baseball and softball. And they come in, they buy the clothing, they wear it proudly, and it's great. It's nice to see.
Girl, tomboy.
Listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.